Good morning.
Without you holding me up, not strong enough for both of us.
They're ahead by a length. It's Ireland from Germany, and history is made of the water in Tokyo as Vincent McCarthy and Paula Donovan win gold. Gold for Ireland.
You're like, you're very happy winning, obviously, but at the end of the day, then you kind of forget about it and get on with life.
And there she is.
Yeah, the big smile on her face. Mona McSharry.
They weren't all PBs, but I was just happy to race, and I don't think I've seen myself smile that much walking out to a race in a long time. Don't hide your emotion.
You can throw down your guard. Jack, commiserations. It's not what you dreamed of.
It's tough to take, and it will be. You know, some people have come here to participate in the Olympics. I came here to win it, and I could have just outperformed like that. It wasn't my day.
He's done it. He's done it. He's beaten the world champion. Kurt Walker is through.
What were the tactics, Kurt?
Just be fast, head first and get out last. That's it.
Australia win it, Netherlands second, and Ireland are home for third and a bronze.
We knew we had a good chance going into it, definitely. Yeah. We just didn't give up.
The first Irish women to win Olympic rowing medals.
I'm with Fergal O'Callaghan, the Irish rowing team manager. Fergal, it's a real case of the highs and lows today. We had the two boys, of course, winning gold in that incredible performance, and then a devastating blow for Sunita.
It's just terrible. I have tears of joy for the boys and tears of sadness for Sunita.
Aidan, congratulations. You now have joined the list of Ireland's boxing Olympic medalists.
I don't even know what to say. That it's crazy. There's just so much support that I'm just so grateful. Can't believe it.
For 100 metres hurdles, heat 3. Thomas Barr, lane 7 for Ireland.
And again, Thomas Barr looking in good position here. He's always got something for the last few hurdles. Barr gets second place, as expected.
Gold medalists and Olympic champions, Ireland.
Vincent McCarthy and Paul O'Donovan, Olympic champions.
Bend your knees and mind your back, Ireland, lifting all of those medals. Gold from Fintan McCarthy and Paul O'Donovan in the lightweight double sculls. Bronze from Afric Kyo, Emer Lam, Fiona Murta and Emily Hegarty in the women's four rowers. And bronze, at the very least, from boxer Aidan Walsh. And that montage, courtesy of yesterday's Morning Ireland. They do be mad for the montage over there. Well, the morning after the night before, to mix up our time zones, Des Cahill spoke to our gold medalists and tried very hard to learn the secret of their success. Surely it can't just be the training.
Can I ask you, first of all, maybe Fintan, would you take us through the race? Like, Germany and Italy went off. Tell us your tactics relative to that.
We kind of always expect them to have a quick start. You know, we've been racing them all year, and that's generally how the races have gone. The Germans, the Italians get out fairly quickly, and then we try and reel them in. It was kind of, you know, the usual, really.
But I was amazed, because Paul, you said afterwards, when you were asked about your success, you said it's down, you work hard, but surely every crew works hard. Now, I know you're not here to say, well, we're fantastic as well, and it's not your style, but there has to be something more than just hard work to be Olympic champions.
I suppose, well, like, depends on how far deep you want to go into things. Like, there's boats and coaches and support staff and all this type of thing. And
so what? You have the best boat and the best coaching staff.
We have a good boat anyway, and the best coach, world coach of the year there, 2018, yeah. Dominic Casey. Yeah. So we can't complain with that either. Yeah. There's a lot goes into, like, a lot of sports science, physiology, biomechanical testing, and then George's the mother at home and the father and the grandmother and all the support they'd be giving us and all throughout the years. And, like, you need so much luck as well in that, like, just say that we were actually born in the place that we were born, and there was a rowing club nearby, and that say myself and Gary got a bit of luck then going to Rio, and that we were brothers, and so we both liked the same sport and did that, and then lucky that Fintan was there and watching and in the rowing club, and then that he trained really hard and made it into the boat, and just a whole load of different events then like that and you can't kind of summarize it all, like, and put
all of those things together.
Yeah, all together, but fundamentally, like, it's just, I suppose we did an awful lot of training, like, really, that's kind of the main ingredient.
Cool as a breeze. Now, what about Mammy O'Donovan, Trish?
What was it like watching it?
Horrible.
Oh, I can imagine.
Looking at it on the screen, like, you want to be there, you know. But anyway, we stood up when we sang the national anthem and all of that after the medal ceremony and stuff, so yeah.
But you probably knew fairly early on that they had it in the bag.
Yeah. Sure, Jason Osborne. In the German boat, he's giving up now, so he's gone cycling. They were never going to be in contention with them. Like, they race them all the time. The Norwegians now might have given them a run for their money, but they capsized, so they were out of it. But then Paul and Fintan could have capsized. Yeah. You don't know.
And Paul, as always, just listening to him chatting to Des there earlier this morning, he's so laid back, isn't he, about the whole thing?
Paul laid back, any more laid back and he'd be dead. He'd be a corpse, like. You couldn't shake him up.
And of course, that gold medal hot on the heels of the bronze for the women's four.
And history is made as the Irish women's four take the bronze medal at the Olympic Games, and rowing becomes the first sport since boxing in 2012 to win medals at consecutive Olympic Games for Ireland. And that is a terrific performance by the Irish four of Afric Kyo, Emer Lam, Fiona Murta and Emily Hegarty.
Afric, you're here with your medals around your neck. Can you sum up to us what it feels like and what it means to have that around your neck?
I think it just means the world to us, and I think it's just, like, I know none of our families and friends are here, but the amount of support we've gotten for them and to have something for them to cheer and be excited about is just unreal, and the amount of work that the four of us and the rest of the team have put in has just been phenomenal, so we're just delighted to come away with a medal.
And Emer, I know that watching on back home, with your sister Claire, she got into a final with Sinead back in Rio, and your parents were there for that. I'm sure you really wish they could be here with you now.
Oh yeah, definitely. But like, even though they can't be, you can definitely feel the support, even if it's the other side of the world.
Fiona, where does this bond come from? How did you gel together so well?
Like through lockdown and everything, we just had so many moments and just a lot of work. It's been a long 18 months together, but you know, we keep each other good company. We're lighthearted, good crack. We'll look back on this for the rest of our lives.
And Emily, you're the baby of the group from Skibbereen.
So I think it's really, really exciting for all the youngsters in Skib coming up, that like there's no limits.
Square and featherate rowers of Ireland. That was Claire McNamara with our bronze medal holders. And on Thursday, Claire spoke to Violet Hayes, vice chair of Skibbereen Rowing Club, a club that had birthed so many medal holders.
Everyone asks, don't they, what's in the water at Skibbereen? How is this club so successful? Whatever the answer is, you can't deny just how wonderful this club is at winning at an international level.
Yeah, it's amazing, Claire. I don't think anything phases them. You see, look, they train an amazing stretch of water, but it's the same all over the country. Rowers train very, very hard, and they really have to dig deep. Rowing is not a cheap sport. It takes an awful lot to get the best equipment, and that's something, I suppose, the coaches led out by Dominic Casey and the committee have always worked very hard to make sure that all the young people coming in have the best opportunity. And the other thing is, we have a schools program, a primary school program, and young people get the opportunity to sample rowing. So it takes the elitism out of it. It's very much a club of the community.
Well, the medal tally that you have now in one town will beat some countries, I'm sure.
Well, we won't say, but our nearest neighbour, I think, is really kind of trailing behind Skibbereen at the moment in the medal tally.
You have more medals than Team GB in rowing.
Absolutely, absolutely. But we're not going to gloat.
No, but it's an extraordinary fact all the same.
Perish the thought. And here are some people in Skibbereen, courtesy of Gail Conway on the News at One. They too, absolutely not gloating.
Oh my God, isn't it wonderful? We are so proud of them, like, they're amazing, absolutely amazing. It's great, it's absolutely wonderful.
We're just on a high. Speechless. won't be speechless when they come home, though. Do you know?
Total elation. I mean, Fintan with the hand up after he won and everything else, like, first time out there. Fantastic for the town, fantastic for the country. Just brilliant.
Another great thing for Cork, so delighted with myself. Delighted.
It's as if he was in the boat. And then yesterday, we had Aidan Walsh secure a bronze medal in the boxing. And just after that fight, he talked about being inspired by fellow boxers from his native Belfast.
I watched all them guys all the time. Paddy Barnes, McConnell and in the gyms and seeing them coming back to Belfast and the big buses and all. And I was down watching and going, it's hard to believe, it really is.
And you've got more in the tank for Sunday?
Big time, big time. Just keep getting better and better every fight. I'm just so grateful to be here. I just want to keep pushing on now.
And for Aidan, it was all about his big sister and fellow Olympian, Michaela. She talked to Claire yesterday.
From a very early age, I just knew he was special. He just something about him that he had to say. Like people say in the X Factor, it's something you have, it's something about you.
Mm-hmm.
And for him, he has the X Factor. There's just something about him that makes him so great. And I always believed in him. So when I seen him messing about or whatever, I was saying, Aidan, keep your head down. Like, one day it's all going to pay off. And today is the day it's paid off.
Can you tell us a little bit about the preparation that you and Aidan have had to put in to get to these Olympics? That's probably an impossible question to answer, but can you just encapsulate how it has impacted the rest of your life, Michaela?
You know, the sacrifices that you have to make, not only for a boxer, but for any Olympic athlete, you know, you basically give up your whole childhood. You know, there's parties you can't go to, meeting friends, weddings, funerals. There's been so much important events that you have to say no to, even watching your weight. If you're out and you're in your granny's house and she says, do you want a biscuit? And you're making weight, you have to say no, like just the small stuff. And obviously the training that goes with it, the amount of sacrifices and how dedicated you have to be to make it to the Olympics, you know, that's what makes it so special. You're walking around the Olympic Village, you're with the best athletes in the world right at this moment.
A suitably proud Michaela Walsh, and Aidan fights on Sunday, so alarm set and coffee brewing for that one. And while medals, wins and achieving personal bests are great, losing? Well, it hurts. And how much it hurts is underscored by just what you have to give up to be a contender, to go up against the very best. And among the many fine Irish competitors who gave their all but were disappointed, a special shout out to rower Sunita Pushpour and Annalise Murphy in the sailing. They did us proud. Our very first Taekwondo competitor was Jack Woolley, and his Olympics ended last weekend. He spoke to Paula Flynn.
I'm proud of myself to get here, but like I said, I'm very disappointed. Then I feel like I let a lot of people down. But they'll always tell me I didn't, just being nice and stuff, but I just wanted to say sorry to a lot of people for my performance. But, you know, it's not every day you get here, so hopefully everybody's not too disappointed. And yeah, there's a lot of emotions.
I understand, Jack. I can tell you, you've no need to apologise to anybody. You've done the country proud. You've made history today.
Thank you.
I know it's so difficult, but you have made an Olympic Games and you have represented your country at the Olympics.
Thank you very much.
Oh, on Wednesday, Jack's mother, for it was a week of proud mammies, it must be said, Annette Woolley, joined Claire.
He's still really down. He's still beating himself up over. But it's kind of like, as I said, but he just never listens to mommy. But even though I said, like, you might not have won the medal that you went out for, but you definitely won the heart of the nation. He's made history. He's continuously made history in his sport. Like, he was the first ever, I think, European medalist. He's several European medals. First ever Grand Prix fighter, first ever Grand Prix medalist. Like, these are big things within that sport. It was hard. Like, I didn't cry when Jack lost. Like, and I was only afterwards I was told about the interview, so I had to go looking for it. And then I cried. It wasn't because he'd lost. It was because Jack, fair enough, he is honest. And that's one of the things I'm most proud about him for. It's not winning medals. It's not kind of being champion. It's about how honest and vulnerable and just his ability to be him is what I've always been the most proud of.
And there could be no doubting Jack Woolley's achievement and the sacrifices he's made to get to that level.
I think it was 12 or 13 we were in at an Olympic training camp. In Greece while the Rio games were going ahead. Oh no, London 2012 games were going ahead. And I specifically asked the two coaches that were there, because they were both Olympic coaches. And I said, look, I want an honest answer. I'm going to ask you a question. I want an honest answer. I'm not a mammy who just wants to be told her kid is great. You know what I mean? I know how good he is, but I don't need kind of anything sugar-coated. I said, does Jack have what it takes to become a world champion or an Olympic champion? Because this thing is costing us a fortune, and I'm probably going to have to mortgage my house. Because the travel is intense, and the equipment's not cheap, and there was no funding. You know, Jack became world number one at the lower weight, minus 54, there a few years ago, without any funding.
Gosh.
You know, it was just all fundraising or savings. Or, like, Jack made Ninja Knot cookies. He got chickens, he sold eggs. He used his communion money, do you know what I mean, that he'd saved up to get himself to competitions. You know, it's not just us and friends and family and all these supporters who have been out there backing us up, but he has to realise that he's the one who got him there.
Annette Woolley, mother of Jack, with Claire on Wednesday. But competing on the world stage in an Olympics can be massive pressure. And the decision by gymnast Simone Biles to withdraw from the US team finals to mind her mental health was a shock for Tokyo 2020 and may turn out to be something of a game changer. On Tuesday, Mairéad Kavanagh, Deputy Chair of Gymnastics Ireland, spoke to Drive Time's John Cook.
She's under savage pressure, she is, because when you look back at 2016, she came in, you know, the Olympics was new to her, she was the new kid on the block, and she was winning all around her, nobody could beat her. But so there was no previous expectations on her from her previous Olympic Games, where now you're looking at the American team, she's the only one that is a previous Olympian. So everyone's looking to her for, you know, to produce the results. They know that they need her to produce the results. And it showed today that, you know, the Americans came out with a silver medal, so she just felt the pressure. She
right.
was posting on social media that she was feeling the pressure, that everyone thinks that everything's so easy for her, but it's not, you know, she's human.
But when it comes to raw talent, Biles is without parallel.
This is a gymnast who's doing the most difficult things in the world that have never been seen before.
What's it like to see her perform in front of you? You've been impressed.
Oh, wow, she's amazing. Yeah, absolutely. You know, when you're judging her, and especially on vault, and you judge her and you know she lands, you're saying, oh my God, that's zero. Like, she's literally got maybe a 0.1 deduction, 0.2 deduction. She's just technically so good. And she's got a move in every apparatus named after her. She's doing things that we never thought would be done. And there's nobody matching her in that difficulty. But with difficulty comes high risk. But she is... You know, when you see her flying through the air and doing what she's doing, it's breathtaking.
And by the end of the week, Simone Biles would make the decision to withdraw from the Olympics to protect her body from injury in a very dangerous sport and mind her mental health.
Put mental health first, because if you don't, then you're not going to enjoy your sport and you're not going to succeed as much as you want to. So it's okay sometimes to even sit out the big competitions to focus on yourself, because it shows how strong of a competitor and person that you really are, rather than just battle through it.
And for an athlete of the stature of Simone Biles to make that decision, well, it's big. Ray spoke to sports psychologist Dr. Olivia Hurley.
We need to remember that we've paid a lot of lip service over the last couple of years to people coming out and saying, I'm not okay. And we've used taglines like, it's okay not to be okay.
Yeah.
We've talked the talk. Now we have to walk the walk with them.
Okay.
We've given them that license to say, yes, please do speak out. What Simone has actually done is probably shown that, as I said, they're not invincible. And there may be many other athletes who will say now, I need to take a look at myself and I need to work on this area in order to be able to handle this pressure.
Okay.
Because nobody's immune to it. If she's not immune to it, nobody's immune to it.
Back in a bit. Welcome back. Do sharks have feelings? And if they could, would they talk to Joe about their pain? Well, this Liveline discussion was prompted by a photograph of a massive shark landed on the deck by a proud amateur fisherman and subsequently released back into the sea. But the image caused outrage and accusations of cruelty. Niamh waded into philosophical waters deep with the sceptical Joe Duffy.
But there's blood on the shark. The shark, I'm sure, was in pain. any creature like that that you would drag, I mean, the whole weight of its body being pulled up by a hook onto a boat, a photograph being taken, and then it just being tossed aside. And the guy said he cared about the welfare of the shark. I'm not sure about that.
What are you sure the sharks experience pain the way we do? Because that's what you're saying, isn't it?
Well, they have a central nervous system.
Yeah.
And the nerves have the sense to feel the pain. So that's how you know that
but
they
how
have
do you know,
that
how,
feeling.
Yeah, but how do you know they experience pain the way we... I know you're talking about A into B equals C, but how do you know they experience pain the way we experience pain? Which could be horrific, as you know. That's what people immediately hear when they... But how do we know?
How do we know?
Where does that leave us in terms of the world? Like, do we not... Like, sharks aren't human. Animals aren't human by definition, obviously. But we keep saying they're sentient beings, as if they're close to being human. They're no more... They're not close to being human. They're a few million, hundreds of millions of years, maybe, down the road. But they're not close to being human, so...
So indeed, all the big questions Joe eyebrow raised to Neves. Let me convince you.
Let's put it this way. Because you're talking about a shark, and I know I can sense that you're feeling far removed from the shark, all right? So let's say it's your pet, it's your cat or your dog.
And I don't know
right?
anyone has sharks as pets.
Yeah, so that's what I'm saying. Let's just, because you're asking me about, yeah. Do they have feelings? Why should we care, basically? Because we don't know if they have any feelings. So let's just
no,
do
we don't know
this.
If they have feelings as we do. We don't know if they experience pain
but sure,
as
one
we
person,
do.
We
can
yes,
surmise.
But even with people, the way one person experiences pain can be different to the way another person experiences pain. And we are talking about physical pain. There's a whole, there's mental pain, there's emotional pain, there's loads of different kinds of pain. And there's loads of different experiences in relation to that. So if my dog went out and bit onto a hook and somebody lifted my dog up with a rod or whatever up with the hook in the roof of its mouth, I'm pretty sure my dog would feel pain. It probably wouldn't even be screaming because it has a hook in its mouth. And I know that people will be outraged at that comparison. And for some reason, people are able to switch off when it comes to something like a pig or a shark or a chicken or a cow or a lamb, which is a baby animal. And people are, oh, my God, those puppies, you know, when puppies are being stolen from people's yards and the poor puppies and the poor babies. And yet they're able to eat lamb on a Sunday or whatever. Mm. And I just, for me, as a person, I don't understand how people just don't feel the connection. They don't see the connection. This animal, this animal, this animal, they all feel pain. Of course they do. And they have a central nervous system.
And if you
which
had to,
means,
okay, for example, should animals ever be culled?
No, I don't think so. I think that's outrageous. And I think...
So like, let the deer in the Phoenix Park ramble and live in Ballyfermot.
Well, which was there first? The deer in the land or the people in the urban sprawl?
Are you for real?
Where is the problem?
Niamh, are you for real?
Yes, I'm very much for real.
Liveline, quite the discussion. And more complexity on Mooney Goes Wild in their bird special. Should you feed the birds? Pros and cons, but overall conclusion, grand, or words to that effect. But this from Niall Hatch gave pause for thought.
One of the things, though, that I'm getting quite interested in is the ethics behind the sources of food that you're using. Because different manufacturers and different companies use different sources for food. It's not very transparent. We don't necessarily know where they come from. But we do know that there's a lot of bird food grown in parts of South America and in parts of Asia, particularly in China. In some cases, it could be that deforestation is happening to plant these seed crops of sunflower seed or peanuts or whatever they may be to feed
specifically for feeding birds.
Specifically for feeding birds.
Is the business that big?
There's a lot of money in this. Well, we were talking about the number of bird watchers around the world. Mm. The number is certainly increasing, whatever that number is. And that's people, particularly in more affluent countries, feeding birds in their gardens. And we even have situations where it's been seen in Argentina, for example, where there's rare birds, they're called seed eaters. They're a bit like our finches. small little birds that eat seed, as their name would suggest. Some of those are very rare and very threatened. But there have been cases where people have been using nets to trap them, to keep them away from the lucrative seed crops that are then exported to Europe to feed the birds in our garden. We know that a lot of pesticides are sometimes used to grow peanuts for birds in China, and then these peanuts are exported to Europe. But the local birds, some of the rare buntings, are suffering as a result of that. So I think what's going to happen in the years to come, the focus on the provenance of bird food is going to become much more important. But people feed the birds because they want to help them. But ultimately, if that is hurting birds around the world and endangering some species indeed, that's maybe not a good thing at all.
From Mooney Goes Wild. Prick up your ears, music snobs. Here comes some autotune.
Autotune is so like heavy on our vocal. It's the most futuristic thing ever, and it almost sounds even more futuristic and out of context. Like, what year was this? 1998. I appreciate it a lot more than I did back then. Probably then I was like a music purist and was like, what is this shit? Like, and now I'm just hearing it and I'm just like, wait, Cher has come back from the past to warn us about the future? Like, what the hell is going on this record?
The amazing Cher and producer Mark Ronson having something of an awakening when it comes to the pop joys of the autotune. And Ronson is the focus for a new documentary series, Watch the Sound, which was previewed by Kate Brennan-Harding on Arena.
Dr. Andy Hildebrand talks about he invented the technology for autotune, which was all about fuel deposits deep underground.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how that became...
We keep going back to fuel and gas and oil, don't we?
But how he turned that into something that initially fixed bad, out-of-tune voices. But then what Ronson cleverly does, he looks at how people started to use it on purpose.
Yeah, completely. Like Kanye West, uses it 808 said on Heartbreak. Like that is absolutely huge album. It's an iconic album. And Kanye is not a singer. And to use that, he was, you know, that album was all about the death of his mother and his grieving process and his own mindset. And Ronson reckons that if it wasn't for autotune, we wouldn't have had the melodies that live inside Kanye's head come out on that album. So, and Ronson also says, recently I read an interview where he was talking about having worked with Amy Winehouse and having seen how she conveyed emotion, he couldn't see or understand how autotune could in turn convey the emotion. But what Kanye did is actually completely bring himself down to this isolated state, this autotune state, this semi-robotic state. And in that, his feelings of despair come out much more so than if there was not autotune used on it.
Yeah, he keeps referring to sad robot sound.
Yeah, and like, you know, there's also this kind of thread throughout the entire series where we're looking at how technology influences and changes music, and we're looking at there's always a backlash. There's always, oh God, no, we don't want that. And that's going to change music in a bad way, and it's removing the human. And what he continuously does, weaving it very cleverly through the series, is to look at how technology progresses. There's a fear, there's a backlash, and then there's somebody who gets it and creates something magic with it.
And she talked about an unlikely synth merchant, Paul McCartney. Who'd have thunk it?
You don't really, in my mind, get bigger than McCartney, do you know what I mean? And McCartney's talking about how he started really getting interested in synthesizers. And he talks about how, you know, the rest of the Beatles are getting annoyed with him because he was trying to get particular sounds correct using, you know, first Moog, which is one of the machines that has generated so many sounds, and so many bands have used that down through the decades.
And with the help of John Lennon's son, Sean, he puts a bit of auto-tune on Lennon's voice to see what that might do.
Yeah, and like Sean Lennon and Mark Ronson are actually childhood friends. So it's kind of like it's a really intimate exploration of what music is.
From Arena. And over on Culture File, more synth. Louise McMahon was with composer Dominic Murcott.
One of the things that would be anathema to so much music is that I'd programmed in a vaguely 3-4-6-8 pattern. And a sequence that fitted that, then I made it longer so the sequence didn't fit the percussion pattern. The vagaries of this setup here is there's no guarantee that beat one of the sequence will fit to beat one of the percussion. And there are ways that I can start and stop that, but I quite enjoyed the jeopardy of not knowing quite how the sequence was going to interlock. If we imagined writing a piece of music for a group of players and not being sure if we all agree on beat one, you know, there's all sorts of music that's going to fail with that. In this particular case, I think it adds to the fun of it.
Culture File. Where else would you be getting it? Now for a gear change. On Monday, Ray spoke to Vera Hughes, the Infant Parent Support Coordinator at Ballymun Youth Action Project, and she talked about how our experience of life when we're teeny tiny babies can have a profound impact on how well we cope with life's challenges. Yes, that beloved euphemism.
Well, I think, you know, we're all products of our early lives. So how you feel about yourself, your self-image, your image of the world, your image of relationships, all form from a very early age. So, you know, you just need to be a good enough mother. I mean, there are times we've all left our babies crying and had a shower, and I don't know how my four anyway, normal looking back and all the things that happened. But you just literally have to be good enough. So if babies are left crying for long periods of time consistently, they begin to get this internal dialogue: I'm not worthy, I'm not loved, the world's not a safe place. And they carry that with them through their whole life.
And sometimes, my understanding is, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, that this may be even a subconscious dialogue, that they may
not... Oh, it is subconscious.
Oh, yeah, that they don't even remember being neglected.
Not at all, not at all.
Because they're too young to remember.
They're too young to remember.
Right.
So you wonder why you're in a relationship with your girlfriend or boyfriend, and, you know, they're looking at somebody and you're completely jealous and you're thinking, oh, they're going to do the dirt on me. Where does that come from?
Yes.
That comes from constantly feeling people are not to be trusted. No one's there for me. And how you regulate your emotions as well. There'll be some people, you know, find emotions really, really difficult. And a lot of the mums I work with find big emotions really difficult. And sometimes these emotions are overwhelming. So to, you know, dampen down those emotions, people either overeat or, you know, overdrink or...
Drugs,
yeah.
And she talked about how we learn to regulate those messy emotions, a learning that begins when we are very small babies.
Well, was there a moment for you, a light bulb moment, where you understood things better?
I think definitely it was working probably in the star and suddenly realising, wow, all the stories from these women. And I just felt, how are they doing as well as they are?
Right.
You know, yeah. I was just... so interested in what happened to them and hearing about the trauma they would have had as a small child. I sort of think, oh, she trauma.
Yes.
Is this the key? They all seem to
have it, yeah.
Have it, you know. So say a toddler is building a pile of bricks and they fall over and he goes hysterical. His world is over. That is traumatic to him. Just can't cope, has an absolute meltdown. And it's how you deal with that. Lets him know what's an okay feeling. So you could say, oh, for God's sake, you know, whatever, yes. Get over yourself. But if you bend down and say, wow, that's really sad. You are really sad and really angry that your bricks fell over. Yeah, yeah, I know. So he's learning, okay, I'm out of my control here, but someone understands from your tone of voice, even if he's too young to understand the words, it's okay, mommy or daddy are here. They're helping me regulate. This is okay. I'm not going to die. You know, this is an okay feeling.
Yeah.
And that's how you regulate.
And she talked about her own work with parents and small children.
So you have to approach what you do with a good dollop of compassion.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Compassion and a sense of humour. You definitely need that or you wouldn't survive.
But a lot of people, I don't think, share your compassion for the people you work with.
I think because you don't know them. Like, say one of the stories would be a mum I was working with recently, you know, this fabulous weather came and she had a beautiful little toddler and I was saying, like, plenty of sunscreen, a hat, plenty of fluids. And she said, absolutely, it was taking it all on board because they really want to be good mums. So she poured a can of Coke into the baby's bottle. Baby's 6, 7 months old. Right. So people would be horrified at that and thinking, God, look at her, she's a terrible mother. But she was given Coke in a bottle as a child. Her younger siblings were, her cousins were.
Mm.
So what's wrong with that?
Yes.
You know, so she, when we talked about that, about the baby's teeth and, the mum hasn't great teeth herself, so she's really conscious of wanting her daughter to have good teeth. So we talked about that, and we gradually got the baby onto dilutable, and now the child's drinking water. But
it's interesting you say that, because, like, I would assume that everybody knows that it's not a good thing to give Coca-Cola to your child, but that's a wrong assumption.
No. Yeah. Do you know, so we're all just products of our upbringing.
How true. That was Vera Hughes from Ballymun Youth Action Project with Ray. Now, with all the love for our athletes doing the rounds, deflection of praise? Sure, Ireland did get gold every time in that one. It was only a bit of luck. The wind blew me up onto the podium. Just why can't we take a compliment, the good word? Here's Ian Robertson, clinical psychologist and neurologist with Sarah on Drive Time.
You know, the way it would go here, for example, if someone complimented me on my dress, my temptation would be to say, you know, it's only pennies, or usher this old thing, or to play down the compliment immediately, to try and reject it in some way. Why do we do that?
Well, it's because there is, particularly, I guess, in Scottish and Irish and Scottish cultures, there's a kind of, you know, there's the tall poppy syndrome. We don't want to be seen to be pushing ourselves above other people. So there's this habit of preemptive self-criticism to try and, you know, stave off other people criticizing you, because, you know, other people's negative evaluations of us is the greatest source of stress. And the trouble is with that kind of putting ourselves down a little bit, I'm talking rubbish, you know, you probably don't want to listen to what I'm saying. That kind of stuff actually it reduces our anxiety temporarily in the short term, but in the long term it sabotages our confidence.
And which of us needs that? But how do you give a compliment without sounding just a bit like a bit of a lick?
How will it be received? Will I be seen as, you know, a bit false or a bit over the top or a bit fake, you know, if I'm just sort of doling out compliments to everybody all around me?
Yeah, you don't want to devalue the currency too much by being seen, you know, being indiscriminate in your, you know, you know. So you want to make, that has to be clearly obvious to the person you're complimenting that actually, you know, the dress is nice and not a mess.
Okay.
So there has to be some authenticity to it, because, you know, if it's seen as being fake or not authentic or cheesy or manipulative, then of course it won't work. But, you know, most of the time we compliment too little. I don't know who it was said, but some famous person I've been trying to find out said his greatest regret in life was, I wish I had praised more. And that stuck in my head 30, 40 years ago. And I've always tried to do it, even, you know, just with people I don't know, just to say, God, that's, you really did a great job there. Even someone passing, you know, in the street, or, you know, in the cleaner in an office or something like that. You can underestimate the really positive benefits it has.
Okay, well, we will all keep it in mind. Ian Robertson, clinical psychologist and neurologist, you're great. Thank you very much for joining us.
From Drive Time. Now, sharp ears might have noticed a distinct absence of the COVID in this week's playback. Not that there wasn't news on that front, vaccines for 12 to 15-year-olds being the biggie. And yes, COVID numbers are up, but the vaccination rollout is also hurtling along, with over 70% of the adult population fully jabbed, and we now have walk-in centres swanky. Even NEFID seemed cautiously optimistic. And while we're not out of the woods yet, might we be backing out ever so quietly? Shh, don't scare the variants. Well, for some, though, this past 18 months has been a vindication of sorts, because if you are a survivalist, or prepper, as they are now called, might you have been a tad smug with your neatly stacked tins of tomatoes and your water purification tablets?
They were better prepared than most people. I know a number of the prepper communities that I worked with were able to retreat to their bunkers in the first few weeks and months of the pandemic, which, you know, as everyone remembers, we didn't know how it lived on surfaces. We didn't know how it traveled necessarily. And so there was a lot of uncertainty. They were able to retreat to their communities. But once they were in there, they could create their own bubble. And people within those communities had complementary skills, so they could assist each other in staying inside their bubble as long as they needed to. They didn't need to go to grocery stores, you know, while the rest of us were panic shopping for water and toilet paper. They were safely waiting it out to see what was going to happen.
That's Bradley Garrett, cultural geographer at UCD and author of Bunker, Building for the End Times. And in writing that book, he spent 3 years living with people with the eye ever on Armageddon. He took Oliver on a whistle-stop tour of bunkers. First up, a Cold War classic from the late 50s, the Burlington Bunker in Wiltshire.
An incredible facility with 60 miles of roads, again, radio broadcasting facilities, kitchens, a reservoir where they can pull drinking water. And what was most interesting was a library that was still stocked, that had every book, map, diagram that you would need to reconstruct the UK in the event of an all-out nuclear Armageddon.
Wowzers. But the UK's eye is wiped by Switzerland. Have a listen to this.
Probably the most prepared country on earth. They've got underground hardened bunker space for 110% of the population. Which is very interesting. I guess they just maybe, you know, if they assume...
Which is over 8 million people.
Over 8 million people,
they can fit into their bunker.
Yeah. A lot of them are infrastructural spaces, like the undersides of road bridges and things that they've just adapted so they can close off a door, and they've got nuclear, biological and chemical air filtration. They can house the entire population of the country and then some.
But if you were to head down into a bunker for a few years, perhaps exclusivity might be on your mind. In which case, put a down payment on this bad boy.
The most extravagant bunker that I visited was in Kansas. A real estate developer called Larry Hall purchased an Atlas F nuclear missile silo from the U.S. government. This was a decommissioned missile silo. It's about 60 meters deep. And he pumped water out of this missile silo. Obviously, the missile is no longer in it. He pumped water out of the silo and he turned it into a subterranean condominium complex. I call it a geoscraper in the book, sort of the opposite of a skyscraper.
I thought it was an interesting term because you just literally picture a skyscraper that goes in the opposite direction.
Exactly. Yeah. So as you descend into the earth, you're moving through floors of people's condos. And he was selling half floor condos for 1.5 million and full floor condos for 3 million. And they sold out within months.
Wow.
He's got 57 people in there now with space. And they're also recreational facilities. He's got a shooting range, a swimming pool with a waterfall, a cinema, a bar. I'm not sure the bar is a great idea if everyone's locked in there for a long time. But
and how long would they be able to survive without having to surface again?
5 years.
5 years. I think you'd need the bar. Now, that's Americans for you. But what about here in Ireland? What are our options? Hunkering down behind a hawthorn? Not if you're in Ireland's hidden heartlands.
The government here, just after the Cuban Missile Crisis, constructed a bunker in the middle of the country that was...
Athlone.
Athlone, yeah, exactly. That was for government officials, essentially. It's still there, yeah. It's been decommissioned, and I think they've stripped out all of the infrastructure. I mean, at one point, it still had the kitchens. There were RTE broadcasting facilities inside the bunker.
Well, they were planning to move the government in the event of a catastrophe to Athlone, which would become the new capital of Ireland, which they'd be delighted to hear.
That's right, yeah.
And RTE would have to broadcast live from there.
Yeah.
Because not even a nuclear attack would stop the national broadcaster. Oliver with Bradley Garrett and Bunkers We Have Loved. Well, that is it for this week's playback. Thank you for listening. Talk to you next week, maybe weighed down by even more medals. All eyes on Tokyo.